Ready to go ahead? Okay, we're going to call to order the Climate Protection Committee meeting. We have a roll call.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of June 10th, 2019, Director Haggerty, Director Hudson, Director Kim, Director Niss, Director Ross, Director Wagon Connect, Director Wilson, Director Zane, Vice Chair Joya,
here.
Committee Chair Barrett,
here.
Board Chair Rice, we have a quorum.
Oh, okay, thank you. Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So do we have any public comment cards on non-agendized items? No. Okay, so approval of the minutes from April 22nd.
Second.
Okay. Do we need to vote on that, or we just accept them as submitted?
You need a vote.
Okay, so all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Unanimous approval. Update on the Community Choice Energy Study.
Chair Barrett.
Yes.
We have Mr. Ben Foster with us today. He is the commissioner for San Jose Clean Energy. He's also the president of Fostera, a firm that provides green energy and clean transportation expertise to the commercial, government, education, and utility sectors. Ben partnered with Kyoto USA on this effort and was the lead technical analyst for the study. Abby Young, the climate protection manager, will give some introductory slides providing some context of the Air District's involvement with the Community Choice Clean Energy idea.
There we are. Good morning, Chair Barron and members of the committee. Before I hand this presentation over to our invited guest, I'm going to take a moment to kind of remind us of how the Air District has worked with Community Choice Energy programs over the past few years to help support their work. So we started back over 10 years ago in 2007 when we issued our first round of climate protection grants. A couple of those went to two of what are today's longest standing community choice energy programs in the Bay Area. We provided some of the startup funding for Marin Clean Energy, and we also provided some very, very early stage funding for surveying and feasibility exploration for Sonoma Clean Energy, Clean Power. So both of those community choice energy programs were started up in part with Air District funds. We also participate as a sponsor and speaker in the annual statewide conference of community choice energy programs. The next one's coming up next week in, or perhaps it's even this week, down in Southern California. And fast forward to this year, we are issuing, in some of the recent climate protection grants that we've issued, we've included a couple where we are also supporting community choice energy programs, the Silicon Valley Clean Energy Program, as well as the East Bay Clean Energy Program, to implement different types of activities that help them further reduce greenhouse gas emissions within their service territories. So this is a long-standing collaboration that we've had with Community Choice Energy over the past few years. And then today, we're talking about a recent study that we worked on with Kyoto USA. And some of you may remember a few years ago, we partnered with Kyoto USA to develop some solar master plans for school districts. So that's the same organization that performed this study in partnership with Fostera. And we were inspired to take on this study in part by the decision of the town of Portola Valley to join Peninsula Clean Energy when it first started up, not at the the default electricity product that was offered that all of the other cities were joining at, but rather they looked a bit ahead and they said, well, what if we were to enroll all of our municipal and residential and commercial accounts in the deepest green, the 100% renewable energy product. And that gave them a bigger bite at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So they reduced emissions quicker and deeper than they would have if they had enrolled where everybody else was enrolling. So we thought, well, that's interesting. What if, what's the feasibility of more cities doing that? So I think Kyoto USA reached out to us and said, this is a really interesting topic that we've been studying. So we issued a contract to them, and they partnered with Fostera to do a study of just that question. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Ben Foster, who is an economic consultant, and he also serves on the Community Advisory Commission for San Jose's Clean Energy Program. So the red means it's on, and then that's your slide.
Excellent. Thank you, Abby. And thank you to the committee for the opportunity to come and address you and share some of our findings from this report, because I think you'll find it interesting, not only in light of the work that we did under this contract, but also as how it can apply to your overall goals for the entire Bay Area. I think we covered that one. So what we've laid out here is a typical progression towards those common goals that cities have and counties and the community at large with a CCE, Community Choice Energy. Typically, we know that the cities set a community-wide carbon-free goal. Many of your cities have already done that. One of the fastest ways and best ways that have emerged to reach those goals is to create a CCE that has those goals for 100% clean power at some point in the future. Then enabling that CCE to purchase the power at bulk, at lower cost, and competitively with PG&E or alternative sources. And then that enables the city to select as a default a carbon-free product. In other words, a way to jumpstart or leapfrog those incremental efforts that are happening with PG&E, allowing the city to achieve its carbon-free or electricity emissions goals. And what I heard from the last meeting was all the efforts around decarbonization. So this is a way that ties directly into having the maximum impact. So if you were to switch from natural gas to electricity, of course, you want to have the cleanest electricity supply possible. So our goals at a high level from a project goal perspective was to look at 7 self-selected communities. So there are a total of 11 cities plus unincorporated Alameda County that are part of EBCE. 7 of them stepped up and said, we'd like to be part of this study to look at their options to go 100% renewable energy as a default for residents, businesses, and municipal accounts. So we had 3 tasks within the report. The first one was looking at current state, what's happening across the Bay Area, across the state, as it relates to CCE renewable energy products and prices, and looking at the comparisons of the energy mix. Task 2 was then working with the 7 cities, and you see them listed here. There's a wide variety from Albany to Oakland. At what are the potential for them individually to look at clean power options that could be available through their CCE, and what would be the impact for their customers and for their energy mix and the ability for them to reach their individual GHG reduction goals. And then finally, to develop a report and the findings from those 2 tasks and provide those cities with the input on choices that they can make, provide that information back to EBCE, work with the staff there so they can see what those recommendations look like, and find ways to push the envelope to go faster on achievement of GHG reduction. Also sharing the findings in other forums like here as well with you. Why this is important from a study perspective, you heard a little bit from Abby earlier. We think that the partnership between CCEs and cities is a really great way to get us all to our common goals faster. It does, of course, align with the state goals also for clean energy and GHG reduction. You'll see that with the CCEs that are newly forming, we selected EBCE because it's a newly forming CCE at the time, but there have been others that have started since then. San Jose Clean Energy, for instance, and others around the state have this opportunity as they begin to establish their goals to understand what they could do, what that realm of possibility is to get to the highest and deepest GHG reduction targets. And then it really enables more impact through decarbonization and electrification initiatives that are really pushing the envelope across the state. So let's take a quick look at what are the product options. Some of you may already be in the territory, so you may already be familiar with these. There are three product options right now at EBCE. There's Bright Choice, which is 38% renewable and 85% GHG commitment. Second is Brilliant 100, so that's 100% GHG free. Of that, 40% is renewable. When we did our study, actually, those were the only two products that were available yet. Since we did this study, Renewable 100, which is 100% renewable product, was launched also. So we focused on those first two, and more specifically on Brilliant 100, so a way to get to 100% GHG free. And the way we did that, with the way we looked at the different options and what would be possible for each of the different jurisdictions within EBCE, was focusing on three core questions. And we did surveys of a number of different stakeholders. We had over 14 different points of input that we're trying to balance on how to look at this. But distilling it down, first off, does a GHG, 100% GHG free option actually help the city materially make progress towards their goals for GHG reduction? We found that yes, it does make a massive difference. In fact, in some places like in Hayward, they can actually reach their entire 2010 climate action goal just through going to 100% GHG default on their electricity sector alone. Next would be how much additional cost would be incurred by the customer. So could customers bear the cost of 100% GHG free product? So we were pleased to see that during the development of EBCE, that the Brilliant 100 product was offered at price parity with PG&E. So in other words, for a customer to select 100% GHG free product, they did not have to spend any more than the prevailing price for PG&E. So that was a great opportunity. While that happens to be a little bit more expensive in some ways compared to other CCEs that have a discount, a slight discount, it made the decision easy to go forward. There was no net incremental cost to customers. And then finally, would it have a negative impact or an impact on the viability of EBCE? And in studying the costs and the revenue potential from the 100% GHG free product, the Brilliant 100, we found that, in fact, it would not have any material impact on EBCE. In other words, it's all well within the realm of possibility. In fact, EBCE staff studied that, and they found the same thing, that going, if everyone were to default into 100% GHG free, it would not have a negative impact on the operation. So we were pleased to be able to share some of these early findings and see that the staff itself continued to move forward towards a cleaner energy mix. Some of the actions that have been taken as a result of the study is, in fact, nine of all the 11 jurisdictions, all the cities, have already taken some action, either on municipal accounts or others. These three cities took the most action. So Albany put all of their customer classes up to Brilliant 100. Hayward did all of their customer classes up to Brilliant 100, with the exception of the care customers, so they would have a slightly lower cost. Piedmont put both its municipal and residential accounts, and then there were another six that put their municipal accounts into Brilliant 100, but only municipal accounts so far. So we're pleased to see that action is already being taken. Just to show you that question that comes up frequently, or continues to come up, is, well, what impact does this have on enrollment? What impact, what risks might it have? These numbers come from a report from March. We also have April numbers, which are consistent with this. The EBCE's forecasted opt-out rates was 10%. So from a budget perspective, from a implementation perspective, is if we stay within 10% attrition, in other words, 90% of all of our customers stay in EBCE, then we'd have no problem to move forward. You'll see the opt-out rates. The opt-out rates in the left column there, way within 10%. There's only one outlier in Livermore. And in fact, Livermore and Union City are the two cities that hadn't taken any action. Like, none of their accounts, including municipal, had gone up to the Brilliant 100 program. But the others that are in green or light blue, those have all taken some action. And what's highlighted there is the action they took either to Brilliant 100 or Piedmont going to a Renewable 100 for their accounts. So we're excited to see that if you average out the opt-out rates for Albany, Hayward, and Piedmont, for instance, the ones that were the three most that took the most action, their default rates, or their opt-out rates, are 3.2%, which is right in line with the total overall average. And so there doesn't appear to be any material difference between those cities, those municipalities that chose to, as a default, a higher quality product. So looking forward, we think that there are opportunities for all the communities that in CCEs, not just EBC, but broadly statewide and of course across the region, to opt up to 100% renewable energy. Clearly, any newly emerging CCEs have a opportunity from the beginning to set that expectation, and we see some like Silicon Valley Clean Energy and further south and Monterey Bay Clean Power and also Peninsula Clean Energy to select from the beginning 100% renewable option, or excuse me, 100% GHG-free option. But you could, as annual processes for rate setting and power mix proceed, you could certainly look at those and say, well, could we create a new product that's more cost-effective, or could we change the default energy mix for our existing customers to reach that goal faster? One of the things also that we've been looking at closely is PG&E's forecasted GHG emissions. So what we see is that their emissions mix, their emissions intensity, as well as their renewable energy mix is progressing much faster than what the state mandates are. So I think it'll be important to keep a close eye on that, because at some point where those CCEs have said, we intend to be cleaner on average than PG&E, and typically they are from the beginning, but as PG&E has continued to ramp up their GHG-free content, the CCEs may risk getting, you know, at parity, if not slightly below that average emissions intensity, which we certainly would not want to see happen. And then with that, that's a summary of our findings. It's all available on your website. I'm sure Abby could also provide that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very interesting. Are there any questions before we look at public comment? Yes?
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate this study, and I think I heard from Abby or from at the beginning of your remarks that, of course, you're going to be sharing this information across the Bay Area. So being from Marin County, of course, you know, we definitely, it's so interesting to see now what the opt-out rates are, which have gone down to nil virtually. But here's my question. So I gather now the law allows for the CCE to up everybody to the 100% renewable. We don't need to ask permission anymore from our customers.
Well, what we're suggesting is that base default power mix could be changed over time. It can evolve. So take Peninsula Clean Energy or Silicon Valley Clean Energy. They have their default product is 100% GHG free.
Oh, I see.
So what you could do is say our default now has been moved up to that 100% GHG free product, and then the premium products now could just have more renewable content. So you can still have a premium product that could be all focused locally, perhaps, maybe a little more expensive or other mixes, but that, you know, the default that customers already experience could be pushed up to 100% GHG.
Right. They're not paying it. They're not having to make a change. And
right.
As a customer, the mix is changing.
Correct.
Got it.
Just like with PG&E, if you're a PG&E.
And so that allows the CCE, then they're brokering out ahead, and they can phase that in or get there as they will. Okay, it's really interesting. It's great. And then the other question is, and I think it is really important for the CCEs to stay competitive and also to be advertising, even as PG&E's mix gets more, you know, goes where it needs to be. And of course, it would never have done that as quickly if it hadn't been for the CCEs.
Right.
But one of the things, the benefits of the CCEs is that those would-be profits are actually coming back to the community as opposed to going to. So it's there's a financial incentive as well as the GHG reduction. Incentive. Anyway, really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Director Hagerty.
Thank you. Well, as chair of EBCE, I guess I'll thank you for the study. I would like to know, did we invite the executive director of EBCE to be here today? No? Yeah. Okay. He probably would have liked to have been here. So on the Livermore opt-out rate, that was that's where social media is not always a great thing. And there was a lot of misinformation. It wasn't on Nextdoor. There was a little bit on Nextdoor, but they also have a webpage called Livermore Rants and Raves. And it pretty much tore up EBCE real quick. And it's a shame, because I think people, if they knew about EBCE and knew that they could save, you know, a little bit of money, they would be more than happy to do it. But we continue to work with Livermore. I'm curious, has this study been shared with the executive director of EBC?
We have. We've sent it over to Howard and to Nick.
They're not the executive director.
Sorry.
Have you shared it with Nick?
It with Nick, yes, and Howard. Yeah.
Right. He just asked me if I could get him the study. So who owns the study? Do we own it?
Yeah, we own the study, and it's on our website.
Could you please get a copy of the study to Nick Chassid at EBCE?
Yep, we'll do.
Because he says he hasn't seen it, so I'm a little confused. But I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Other directors? Yes.
Thank you. I just had a comment. I think it would be instructive to people if they saw, although we have such a high opt-in rate anyway, it would be instructive to people if they were able to see what their comparative rate would have been had they stuck with PG&E. And I know that's not on the bill, and I get complaints from people who did opt in to MCE saying, well, I'm paying this extra than I would have been paying if I just stuck with PG&E. And I have to explain to them, no, that's it. I'll spare you all the conversation. I'm just wondering if we have the ability to provide that information, or I doubt that we do, but it would be nice if there was some way we could offer comparisons. I know that's not your bailiwick today, but just to...
Makes it confusing for customers to see exactly what the discount is, because you see the credit, then later on you see the added cost and the PCIA. That would be a good question for your provider, for MCE, where you are, or others, to ask them for ways to make it more transparent, perhaps as a insert or something else, what that percentage is.
Okay, yeah, it's kind of like buying a car, you know, whether you should buy the undercoating or not.
Right. Monterey Bay Clean Power, Community Power, is... they do it as a rebate instead, so I think you pay at parity, but then once a year, maybe once a quarter if you're a larger customer, they show you the calculated how much energy you use and what the cost, and then they provide a rebate as a percentage, like a check back or a credit against your upcoming bill.
Hmm.
So it makes it a little more transparent, like, oh, I paid the same amount, and then here's something back. It's a novel way. I haven't seen that in others, but it's...
And that was Monterey?
Monterey Bay.
Monterey Bay. Interesting. Thank you.
I have a question about how communities get all their residential and commercial. Is it mandatory? I mean, how do they make them do that?
As they opt in, or as those
Is it an opt in situation or an opt out?
So when the CCE is established, the city has the ability to take a vote and. Inform the CCE that they would like all of a certain class of customers to begin at a certain product as their default. That, of course, they could opt down and say, well, I know I'm in this rate, but I would like to opt down or change to a different plan. Of course, they have that ability. Or they could opt out entirely and say, well, I don't like any of this, and so I want to go to PG&E. So the cities have that ability to make that decision on behalf of those customer classes.
Okay, so the example you gave in the beginning of Portola Valley actually getting 100%, that was their goal. Whether or not the reality is the same, is
their goal is to use a 100% GHG-free product for their community-wide, and so they selected that from the options that Peninsula Clean Energy had.
And they said, do we know how that worked out?
Yeah, it worked out. This was one of our early ones. Their opt-out rate, I don't know what the recent one is, but it was maybe 4 to 6%, somewhere in that range, so well within the typical targets that we're seeing at the 10%.
Okay, my other question is, are the community choice aggregate in the different areas having problems providing the amount of 100% renewable or 100% GHG-free energy for the demand on it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So far, we haven't seen a volume at a sufficient level where it has been an issue. Certainly when it's opt-in, as if we go back to the slide that shows, you see on the program enrollment, Bright Choice is the 85% GHG-free. The others where if you're not automatically defaulted into it, you have to make that selection. So you'll see with very few exceptions, there's not a high degree of that opt-in. So the total volume that's being purchased right now isn't in a rate where it's been hard to acquire that amount of clean power.
Okay, thank you.
Can I get a clarification?
Sure.
I'm just sorry. When you said the 4-6 opt-out rate, who were you talking about?
She was asking about Portola Valley in Peninsula Clean Energy.
Yeah. All right, okay.
So do we have any cards, public speakers on this, Marcy?
Jed Holtzman and Tom Kelly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. Jed Holtzman, Senior Policy Analyst for 350 Bay Area, and have done a lot of work on Clean Power SF over the years and getting that launched. So always good to hear CCA in this room. And thanks to everyone for the work. Also good to see, you know, studies that actually result in changes in policy choices instead of just talk. I would highlight, however, that the study seemed to be fostered for the purpose of focusing on 100% renewable energy, but that's not actually part of the study because EBCE didn't yet have a 100% renewable energy program at the time that they were doing the study, which seems like a fundamental shortcoming of the study, considering I think every other CCA program in the region did have a 100% renewable energy program that could have been studied. Here we're really talking about two programs. One is at parity with PG&E and one is cheaper than PG&E. That's not the normal situation that we have going on in the other CCA programs in the region. Typically, what's more common is a program that's either at parity or marginally cheaper than PG&E versus a 100% renewable program that is a, quote, premium product, which is some amount over the PG&E cost. And breaking that PG&E threshold is something that is the actual problem, but this study doesn't address, because we're talking about, at worst, making people whole again, equal with PG&E instead of saving money. So this seems like a real shortcoming, because what folks in the industry, or I should say what folks in the CCA community have been talking about for years, is how are we going to get people, especially, you know, look at these numbers, where you have 100% renewable programs as opt-up programs from your default, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, at most 5% adoption, and that's what you see here. And that's what you see in Marin and Sonoma in general, and that's what you see in San Francisco. And so the real gap that people are talking about is not addressed by this study, and that's basically, how are you gonna get anyone but the Piedmonts and the Portola Valleys of the world to actually move for 100% renewable energy if it's gonna cost them money? And in San Francisco, moving to 100% renewable costs you, on for the average bill, $5 to $6 a month. In the city and county of San Francisco, I think it's reasonable to ask many customers to pay $5 or $6 extra dollars a month. That is nothing compared to these people's income. But yet, there's 3% adoption. And so what we really need to get at is, where is the money going to come from to make the community at large whole, equal, to switch to 100% renewable energy quicker, because that's what we need to get to our climate goals. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, directors. Tom Kelly, Kyoto, USA, and worked with Ben on this study, and just wanted to thank the district and Abby Young for and her team for all the support she gave us in this effort. I just wanted to address a couple of the questions that I heard. One of the things that Ben didn't highlight are issues around the cost of renewable power and people's willingness to pay for that, and also issues associated with people being concerned about climate change and expecting their government to do something about it. And so we found that, first of all, that people are willing to pay more for renewable power if they understand the benefits that are associated with it. That was number one. During the study, we had the opportunity to support some efforts in Southern California, the Clean Power Alliance, where 10 cities actually enrolled all of their customers in 100% renewable. And that included cities like Oxnard, which are one of the lower income communities in Southern California, in part because they actually have two natural gas plants in their city, and they appreciate the value of switching from a renewable source, from natural gas sources to renewable. Those opt-out rates in those 10 jurisdictions track pretty much with what we're seeing here in EBCE. So there's no real impact on the overall number of customers enrolled when you choose or select a better quality default product. Overall, I think there's some fear about opt-outs and prices and everything, but I think that those issues are worth exploring a little bit more because for the most part, we found that they didn't have a significant impact on the programs or the customers. And that's it. I just want to thank you again. Appreciate it very much. And hope that we'll be able to provide more information to you on these efforts in the coming months and years. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that it, Marcy? Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was very illuminating. Thank you,
Chair. Just yes? A couple comments.
Wait, one more.
First of all, one of the things that I wanted to say about BCE is I guess, we are right now the largest CCA in the state. And one of the reasons, I think the main reason is that as we approach this, the county actually paid for it. They paid for all the studies. They paid everything that needed to be done to get them up and going. And so the cities, they were more apt to join coming in, which I think is part of our success. The other thing is I would say that, a lot of communities, I don't know that you can always look at one size fits all. And one of the things that came through as I went through this development process, I think we had 28 or 32 members of the steering committee, which the Board of Supervisors engraced me with. And one of the things that came through loud and clear is they wanted a local development business plan. And that was important to our community. How we put money back into the community, whether it's training people to work on sustainable projects, whether, or reinvesting back into the community, doing things that would help homeowners and things like that. So as we work through this with labor and everybody else, that's what became very important to our community. So I think everybody kind of looks at their community choice aggregators just a little bit different.
Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one, thank you very much. Thank you. Diesel free by 33 implementation plan.
Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the committee. One of our major efforts last year was our diesel free by 33 initiative, where we got folks to sign up to a commitment to remove diesel from their businesses or communities by 2033. Since September, staff has been doing a lot of working and thinking about how we can actually move forward on that particular initiative and to bring the board up to date on where we are. We will have Rainey Chang, our Technology Implementation Officer, step you through how we propose to implement this program rolling forward.
Thank you, Damien. Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee. Before I get to the implementation plan, I want to do a bit of a recap on how the Diesel Free by 33 initiative started and where we've come from. So as Damien mentioned, back in September of 2018, last year, Governor Brown and his office organized a global climate action summit here in San Francisco. And as part of that broader climate summit, the Air District organized a signing ceremony and an event in order to have people in the Bay Area and beyond commit to going diesel free by 33. And the reason for that focus is because diesel particulate matter is something that impacts both climate and health, and it's really aligned with the Air District's mission. So the commitment that people signed on to, the idea was to, by having a commitment, encourage more people to sign on, and then also moving forward, it allows us to have a guiding principle that we can all work towards. So the statement of purpose that the signatories signed on to, the full statement is in the attachment to the board memo, but the critical aspect of the diesel-free commitment was that we would all work together to identify and adopt innovative solutions to eliminate diesel emissions and black carbon from our communities. So currently, there are 118 signatories that are mainly Bay Area cities and counties. There are also a number of signatories from nonprofit organizations, from businesses, as well as regional government agencies, and one city outside of the Bay Area. So over the recent months, we've been working across the Air District in order to map out the implementation plan. The goals for the implementation plan are to support the signatories, that this is a challenging goal that it will take coordinated effort, and people will need help in order to do this. So that's the idea behind the implementation plan goals. We also want to leverage the Air District programs as much as possible, track the progress as we go from today to 2033, and then also push ourselves to achieve greater reductions in diesel emissions than we might otherwise have done without this commitment. And then we also want to extend the impact beyond the Bay Area. When we're talking about climate emissions, it's global emissions that really matter. So as much as we can, we want to have what we do in the Bay Area have influence outside of the Bay Area. There are five program areas as part of the implementation plan, and over the next five slides, I will talk through each of these one by one. So the first one is technical assistance. That's a very foundational one, where if we want to be reducing diesel emissions, we need to know what are the sources and what are the alternatives. And so that's the focus of this program area, to provide data and technical assistance on what the current diesel sources are and the alternative technologies. And this leverages the permitting data that we have, the work that we're doing for AB 617, a number of models, including MFAC, which covers mobile sources, as well as ongoing and regular technology assessments that we're doing for new technologies. The next two program areas are the tools that we have to reduce emissions, either through policy or through incentives. So this next program area, policy support, that's to research and distribute existing ordinances and regulations that can help local governments reduce emissions, as well as developing new model ordinances and best practices in order to support local governments. And this leverages ongoing rural development and planning efforts. So the next program area is grants and financing, providing any upfront funding that's needed to offset some of the upfront costs for emerging technologies and newer technologies. So this program area, the goal is to enhance existing incentives programs through new resources to raise awareness and provide increased support to applicants, and then also look into developing new incentive sources and mechanisms. The next program area, to convene signatories, really reflects the idea that by signing up to the Diesel Free by 33 commitment, you're joining a network. And that network will be a group of people working together to address this challenge. So as part of this portion of the implementation plan, we're going to coordinate reporting from signatories to share progress, and we'll also be organizing staff-level and signatory-level meetings on policies, incentives, and reporting. And again, this leverages a lot of the ongoing work that the Air District is doing to engage government, support peer-to-peer networking, and we also want to align with other major events as much as possible. And last but not least, we want to make sure that the work that we're doing here with the Diesel Free by 33 initiative is shared broadly. So we are developing some new web pages in order to share information and resources. And we'll be looking through various elements of working together with press and social media to expand the signatories in partnership with national and international partnerships. And we also will be looking to highlight major milestones along the way in the media as well. And then looking ahead, some of the immediate next steps are to organize meetings with local government representatives for input on this implementation plan, especially what their needs are for the inventory, what's the format that's most useful, and creating the reporting structure. We want to make sure that, as I mentioned before, that we are providing support to signatories that can help us all achieve this goal. And then we're also working on updating the website for posting resources related to policies and incentives. And then looking longer term, between now and 2033, the initial phase of work with the implementation plan is to establish the diesel-free network, create the relationships and the structures that will allow us to work together, and then transition into accelerating adoption of diesel alternatives. And then the third and final phase is that technology will be evolving over the next few years, so it's hard to anticipate exactly what the technology landscape will be 10 years from now, and so we've left room to adapt the implementation plan in order to adjust for where technologies are so that we can target the remaining sources. So that's the end of my presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions and input from you all.
Vice Chair.
Okay. Thanks for the presentation, the update. So let me discuss an issue which I think is where we can have some meaningful impact, and that's in the land use. So I've asked the State Air Resources Board, and they've done this, to develop a set of conditions for new types of projects, like warehouse projects. And I don't know if I sent those to you, Jack, but it's something that I think this air district can do with projects in the community, because what's happening is there are still many projects in the pipeline that are adding diesel into communities. I've spent dozens of hours dealing with this conditions issue in North Richmond on three large warehouse projects. We're requiring EIRs on these projects, and at the end of the process, we're going to hopefully be imposing conditions on zero emission. That is not what cities are doing. So I think there's a role for the Air District to maybe work with CARB on these common sets of conditions provide comment letters on these projects. And what CARB is doing is they're going to become now a clearinghouse for available technology, so that these conditions can require the available technology to be implemented in these new facilities, which essentially is, all the yard equipment and forklifts and frankly, delivery trucks. These are not what cities naturally do. This is new information. They need help. And our own planning department in Contra Costa has only been doing this because we've worked really hard to develop this linkage on these air quality conditions. But you need to start doing that now, because these projects are already in the pipeline. In some cases, they're in AB 617 communities. Makes no sense to add thousands of diesel truck trips into an AB 617 community when we're, on the other hand, trying to remove emissions and particulate matter. So I would encourage that, and that's something, Jack, that we can begin doing now. I can send you the letters that ARB has sent to a project in Oakland. They're sending one to Richmond. We should be doing that as well, because, it would just, the more kinds of sort of third-party comment letters, but also working to, with these common conditions and helping also identify, you mentioned, identify new technologies. The technology is already there on the warehouse side for mostly zero emission, except for the long-haul trucks, the semi-trucks. And so we need to start using that. So it's fine to develop new technology, But let's start exercising our ability to impact land use decisions. You know, we see the outcome of a bad land use decision, totally a little unrelated with the construction of the school. Let's start being vigilant about this here across the board, especially in sensitive communities where there are sensitive receptors. And I'm glad to sort of provide that linkage because there's the information that CARB has developed I think is very useful. It's only come with a lot of like urging, we need this.
If I can, Madam Chair, Director Joy, if we could follow up with your office to get that, that'd be great. Because it does sound like it's relevant and we could start.
Yeah, it's relevant now. And I don't know the range of projects, you know, all around the Bay Area. But, you know, when you get notified of projects, we can have, especially if it's a new facility, right, we can have tremendous impact by helping local land use agencies impose the conditions that really move these facilities to be zero emissions from the start, right? Because that's where we have the greatest, I think, leverage and possibility working with the land use powers of cities and counties.
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, just to add sure. on to that, and thanks, Renee, for the presentation and this work. You didn't use the word, but I heard it in everything you said, John, about the Air District just being much more proactive.
Yeah. Yes.
And reaching out to communities. And I was thinking about it also in terms of a lot of our cities and towns and counties are going to be in the process of updating our climate action plans. And obviously the diesel free by 33 is a place where we can insert ourselves. And I know there's incentive monies, there's monies out there for climate action planning, but I just think that we can't wait for, and this frankly, the smaller cities just don't have the resources. They are not going to reach out to the Air District. We need to reach out into those communities.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Is there any public comment on this item?
Jed Holtzman.
Yes.
Thank you again, Chair Barrett and Directors. Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area. Thanks a lot to Director Joya. I think that the comment that was just made about kind of looking outside the typical toolbox at the more, I guess, non-traditional or other aspects of the political arena where the Air District might be able to provide its expertise and capacity and useful input in land use. In this particular case, we, of course, would support that. I think also a similar approach in terms of direct advocacy with policymakers is something that was highlighted in the 2017 Clean Air Plan, and certainly in the Legislative Committee, you know, there's some amount of that going on, direct kind of word from the Air District up. But I think in really most of your programs, there's more room for both the board and your staff to kind of directly let cities and counties know kind of where the ship is sailing and what needs to be happening. Because frankly, I think a lot of communities are looking for leadership, and the place that it's going to come is from in here because of the expertise and the experience that you all have. You know, we've been talking to your staff for a little while about some innovative PM work, and you know, we'll certainly talk to you a lot more about that going forward. But mobile sources will be a lot harder to get at in terms of anything that the Air District is going to work on. And for that reason, you know, operationalizing this commitment vis-a-vis actual emission reductions, I think, is really critical. And if we could go to slide 8. We're a little bit disappointed that, you know, we think, for example, the piece of the implementation plan or the goal of achieving greater reductions in diesel emissions, that was presented as one of a few goals, but that seems potentially like the main goal of having the sign-on is not just to have a network, but actually to reduce diesel emissions, hopefully as close to zero as possible. And so we're a little disappointed that there's not even a sketch at the kinds of modalities or suggestions or policies or best practices that the Air District might even be looking at developing, even in terms of categorical, because in a timeline, it seems that this element of the work might not, you know, really be starting in earnest until 2021 to 2028. Certainly, we have plenty of time to reduce these emissions to zero, but since there's already a lot of thought about kind of what direction we need to be heading, it would be great to see, given that this is, you know, the greatest air pollution killer in the region, it would be great to see some ideas about where we are going to push harder, because I think we would all agree that existing air district, city and county policies, state policies are not going to get us to zero by themselves. So we will need to push harder. Thanks.
Yeah. Just to say, I think the idea of just following up to develop, in fact, I just sent you the document. It's called Recommended Air Pollution Emission Reduction Measures for Warehouses and Distribution Centers. And you could do things like this for different types of development, and it both has recommendations both for the construction phase, but more importantly, the operation phase. I mean, really useful. And then if we update what's commercially available, because I think we get, it doesn't cost us any money other than staff time. It doesn't cost us grants and other things. It's the technical, it comes within your the technical expertise side. I mean, I think I worry a little bit that we spend a lot of time saying we want to help develop new technologies. And that's fine. We want to encourage and use our money and leverage it. So is the state, which has a much larger pot of money, is doing the same thing. What we can do differently is we can have impact on the 99 cities and the 9 counties on projects and stop them from bringing in more diesel, which they would otherwise do, because then we're going to have to go spend money to switch out the diesel that they're bringing in their new operation instead of requiring them to have the zero emission that's already available. So I really strongly feel, because I'm seeing the impact of what we can do in our little area in North Richmond, Matt, we can do this barrier-wide. Every community should have the benefit of your expertise on it.
I think that's a great suggestion, and we'll incorporate that into our planning. I also want to clarify, because I think I wasn't explicit enough, that the in terms of these 5 program areas, we're starting that immediately, and the focus is on existing technologies, and then recognizing that there are sources now that don't have great technology alternatives, that's where we'll be tracking the development of technology and adapting the plan to
it's sort of
address
a parallel track.
Right,
I get
exactly.
You're trying to get existing facilities mm-hmm. to be cleaner,
mm-hmm.
but then the easier one is even trying to get the new facilities that are coming in to mm-hmm. be clean from day one.
Director Hudson.
What's his name? I want to make sure I just heard what I heard. What I'm hearing through the chair, John, is to focus on the new. But I thought I heard you say not focus as much on new technology, because to me, the new technology should be an even renewed more interest in it, because it's happening so fast. And I think it really lends to what you're saying. That's why I'm asking. Did I get it wrong?
I'm not saying not to focus on new technology. I'm saying there's already the technology available in many of these areas, so we just need to focus on the land use conditions of new facilities to require them to put in the commercially available new technology that in many cases is zero emission. So it's a parallel track, and because I think we can have just a lot of impact starting today. Like, you know, if someone wants to build a warehouse out in the San Ramon Valley, for example, near one of the business centers, the city of San Ramon planning folks need help to understand what's zero emission, just mm-hmm. like I'm having, the county planners are doing this. And CARB has agreed now to maintain a clearinghouse of what is commercially available, which then gives local land use agencies the ability to say, we know these are commercially available, we are going to require you to put this in. And so what, the developer is going to, you know, moan and scream and say, you're requiring us to do this. Well, we're requiring you to do it sooner than what you will eventually be required to do it. So that's the issue is...
This would include things like charging stations, like, you know, a lot of these places have little carts where they take things from a warehouse, electrify.
Here's an example. If you're going to build a warehouse, because I'm spending lots of time on this, if you're building a warehouse, you're going to build that warehouse to handle the infrastructure to have electric loading docks. You're going to build and you're going to be required to have all your equipment, whatever's commercially available, zero emission. That facility will have all the equipment will be zero emission, the forklifts, you know, all of that. And if you're a big FedEx, your local delivery trucks are going to be zero emission. that's the goal of what we're trying to achieve. And then for the semi-trucks, maybe put a date, because right now that's not commercially available. Maybe it's the low NOx trucks, and then you move to zero emission by a certain date when it's commercially available. So you plug in these future dates, but you take what's currently available and require them to put it in. Okay. What I have found is that the planners who are well-meaning just don't know and have all this information. And that's where they've told me, we need help. What's commercially available? So I think working with CARB on this, because and doing it more focused here in the Bay Area, could be really helpful.
I just gave Karen's card. Sorry.
Okay. So hopefully you can send that to all of us.
I'll send you this.
Okay. Thank you very much, because then we can take it back to our own jurisdictions. All right. Is there anyone else? We're good. Thank you very much. Very good update. Public comment on non-agendized items? No one? Okay. Committee member comments? Okay. We're good. And time and place is Thursday, September 19th.
September 19th, the next one?
Yes. Okay, thank you very much, and the meeting is adjourned.
I'm beginning to see the advantage Nate has.